playback on RT Radio 1. Sponsored by the all-new Irish Times Weekend. With new writers like Marion Keyes and Sean Moncrief, your weekend's in good hands.
Good morning and you're very welcome to Playback with Sinead Mooney standing in for Marion Richardson. It's been a week of high hopes and bitter disappointment on the sporting field, which we, as radio professionals, will have to reflect. So let's get it over with.
Jeg ønsker jer alt held og lykke, men vi vinder. And basically that's saying, I wish you the best of luck, but we're going to win.
Hele hule hule, that was a Danish supporter speaking to Evelyn O'Rourke on Tuesday. And yes, they did win by quite a bit, or as another fan put it.
Especially 5-1, God. You know, 1 or 2 maybe. 5 is a bit hard to take.
Wasn't it just a master of understatement there? However, the next morning, with sore heads and red eyes, we woke up to hear an understandably perky Danish manager, Aage Hareide, chatting to Tony O'Donoghue and thanking us for those diamonds.
Were you surprised at halftime the changes Ireland made? Obviously, we were chasing the game at that point. Maybe Martin had to kind of throw the dice at it.
I don't know. It seems like when I play with two forwards, you know, in a diamond, we got a lot of space central, and that's the danger of a diamond, you know, because we discover that when we train on that, we might have a hope. We hope for them coming in a diamond, so we get more space for Christian, and they did.
Oh, more space for Christian. Well, Tony O'Donoghue then put it up to Martin O'Neill that perhaps we hadn't approached this World Cup quite the way we should have.
We've played 24 games in qualification in the last 2 years. And we've been beaten 4 times, tonight being the 4th time we've been beaten. So there's 20 other games then that we haven't been beaten in. We're in a playoff situation. That's exactly what we were in. So we won some games away from home. We might not have won the matches in the Aviva here, but we've won matches away from home. And so that was hard work. It's always hard work at the end of it all. And you keep going back that we conceded. We scored in the first minute against Serbia. You know, Real Madrid and Barcelona can concede in the first minute and come back, or they can actually score in the first minute and lose the game. That does happen. This is international football. This is big, big football. I think you should got to realise that. This is massive. Just let me finish.
Okay.
Let me finish. Okay. But actually, remarkably, we came back and drew 2-2 with Serbia. We got a goal against Serbia. Serbia won the group. We've gone to Wales and won. We took the lead against Wales, didn't concede then after that. So I think that your argument is back and forward there, Tony. That's the point.
I'm wondering.
Just let me finish. Let me finish. Okay? I'm very important for you to know this. Then, this is tough. This is really tough. We find it tough at the end of the day. We are usually playing against sides of superior quality, usually. We have got a great old spirit in here. We were well beaten tonight. We could have been 2-0 in front. It might have been a different story. Hence, goals coming to change games. That's the thing. We can fight back.
Just let me finish a rather testy Martin O'Neill with Tony O'Donoghue on Wednesday's Morning Ireland. And then, as if we hadn't suffered enough in a double whammy of pain, this happened.
Ladies and gentlemen, it is my great pleasure to announce that the host for the Rugby World Cup 2023 is... France.
Oh, France, okay. Good on yous, well done. Of course, the mark of true character is grace in defeat, many defeats, in fact. But Ryan Tuberty, for one, was not there yet.
By the way, if you're from Scotland or Wales today, you're not welcome. Now, 51551 is the text number. And you know why you're not welcome. You didn't vote for us for the... You know, come on. You're on the naughty step for one day. We'll see you tomorrow. But for now, if anyone's Scottish or Welsh today, no. Bold Scotland, bold Wales, not good and not fair.
He's right there. So no shortbread for Christmas this year, and as for leeks, no. It's Science Week and RTÉ's focus was the weather. And yesterday, meteorologist Gerald Fleming joined Cormac O'Hara for a chat, and Cormac asked him about the recent storm Ophelia.
It was a crazy time, and yet it was a fascinating time because, I mean, this is what we live for as meteorologists, you know, these extreme events. So we're all into
this. The All-Ireland Final.
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, we love our day-to-day work, but when these extreme events, not that we would wish them in terms of the damage they cause, and indeed, very sadly, there were 3 deaths in that storm, but in terms of such an unusual event, such an amazing event to happen, to be able to work with it, track it, talk to our colleagues abroad, you know, and see how our forecast systems handle it. And they handle it really, really well. And I'm talking about the technical models and so on that we rely on, that our colleagues in research have developed for us. It was a really fascinating time for us. And having, if you like, the whole country focused on us for that 24 hours or a little bit more, maybe 48 hours before, it really put us in the spotlight.
Is it you who said that?
George Fleming there. And sadly for us, the winking weatherman is retiring, which means that we will be deprived of that special, intimate little moment every evening. But where did it all come from?
It was just a way, when you come on camera, of, I suppose, creating that connection with the viewer. Because when you're speaking on television in the context of a weather forecast, you might have, I don't know, 800,000 people watching you, but actually you're only speaking to one person, and that one person is, you know, sitting on the sofa in Kildare or in the kitchen in Cork or whatever, going about their business, but you're trying to get their attention. So it's just a way of creating that visual connection between you and the viewer. Mm.
And what a connection, which prompted this.
A texter says, could you ask Gerald, this is radio texter, could you ask Gerald to give one of his famous winks? I don't think so, because he'd be winking at me, and that would be completely inappropriate.
That would not be good, no.
Just a little bit good, Cormac, no? Well, Cormac O'Hara getting the glad eye from Gerald Fleming on Friday. Housing and homelessness were really the key stories this week, and was pointed out time and again, homelessness is the inevitable fallout from our inability to tackle our housing crisis. However, the government were at pains to point out that the use of the word crisis when it comes to homelessness wasn't one that they felt was accurate.
Ireland has one of the lowest levels of homelessness. We're actually a country by international standards compared with our peers that has a low level of homelessness.
It is not good enough that over 3,000 children are without a permanent home, that families are residing in hotels, or that there are individuals sleeping on the streets of our cities. However, neither is it acceptable to hear commentators talking down our country. Over the past few years, we've seen this narrative reflected in the national media. It's been claimed that homelessness in Ireland is at its worst since the famine, that we have a crisis which is worse than Europe, and assertions have been made that homelessness in Ireland is at such crisis levels that we should be excused from the requirements of EU law in responding to the issue. Some of this narrative has seeped into international coverage of our housing system and is damaging to Ireland's international reputation that our social response to this issue is to be portrayed as dysfunctional.
Damaging to our reputation. Well, that was Minister of State at the Department of Housing, Damien English, and Taoiseach Leo Varadkar. And on Wednesday, Eileen Gleeson was taken to task for her comments about people who are homeless. She is the director of the Dublin Regional Homeless Executive. And at a meeting of Dublin City Council's Policing Committee, she had said that volunteers who give food to the homeless are not really helping. She explained her position to Sean O'Rourke.
What I'm saying is that homelessness is complicated, and in providing services there's requirements and standards that should be met, particularly when you're dealing with vulnerable adults and children. And people don't become homeless overnight, usually. It's a chaotic lifestyle that people lead. They have particular problems and they need to be worked with.
Yes, and you say, let's be under no illusion here. This is a quote now. When somebody becomes homeless, it doesn't happen overnight. It takes years of bad behaviour, probably, or behaviour that isn't the behaviour of you and me. Now, what did you mean by that?
And what I meant was chaotic behaviour. What I meant was that somebody becomes homeless for whatever reason. They're on the street, they're begging, they're behaving in a way that isn't the way everybody else behaves. There is issues. They have health issues or whatever they have.
But that's what they're reduced to, Eileen.
Yes, and we need to be able to respond to that. And we need to be able to, when they link to a service, we need to be able to link them to something where we can help them to move forward. And that's what I'm not criticising the volunteers per se.
Yes, and
they're
their motivation.
And
yeah.
They're obvious, or their motivation. Not at all. What I'm saying is that a professional structured support, there will be an outcome. In an unstructured, unprofessional, unstructured
right,
system,
but I'm just
there
wondering.
Isn't an outcome. All they're getting is a soup and a sandwich.
Director of the Dublin Regional Homeless Executive, Eileen Gleeson, with Sean O'Rourke on Wednesday. However, Brother Kevin Crowley of the Capuchin Day Centre took issue with her comments, as did Father Peter McVerry.
if I could come to Eileen, I think what Eileen Gleeson was saying is an insult to many homeless people. First of all, she said, people don't become homeless overnight. The majority of people do become homeless overnight. They become homeless because the landlord evicts them, because they cannot afford to pay the rent, or because the landlord says they're selling their house, or because the banks have repossessed the landlord's house because the landlord hasn't paid their mortgage. The vast majority do become homeless, and to say that it takes years of bad behaviour to become homeless is an insult to the majority of homeless people.
Father Peter McFerry with Sean O'Rourke on Wednesday. But what about those people who do find themselves homeless? On Thursday's News at One, Eleanor Burnhill joined the 11 o'clock night run with Inner City Helping Homeless and talked to those people who take that soup and sandwich.
I often hear people saying that people are on the streets, like, you know, because they're getting all these free things and all that. Like, if you come out here at 2 or 3 o'clock in the morning, anyone you see asleep in a porch, they're genuine people, because no one in their right mind is going to be asleep in a porch at 3 o'clock in the morning in the freezing cold just to get a free jumper, like, you know.
And can I ask how long you've been homeless for yourself?
I've been homeless for about 5 years. I had a break, actually, for a while. And I've been homeless now again for the past 6 months. So I'm hoping not to be homeless for too much longer. You know, something's had to kicking into play now recently for me. Like, you know, so it's hard enough to get a bed in a hostel. Like, there's lots of homeless people. You know what I mean? And there isn't enough spaces. Like, you know, so they can't provide spaces for everybody. It's kind of like, it's like a lottery. You have the free fund, and the free fund, the first. Say, we'll just say, for instance, the first 30 people through get a bed, right? And the rest might have to have a sleeping bag, like. But it's not the same people every night. It changes around, right?
One man getting help from Inner City Helping Homeless. And Eleanor Burnhill spoke to a second man getting assistance from that charity.
Same name as the housing minister, yeah. Owen Murphy. There's a very negative way to look at the people that are homeless. It's a very easy trap to fall into and a very difficult one to get out of. And to paint everybody with the same brush is a very cynical way to look at the current situation.
Can I ask you yourself how long you've been on the streets?
3 years, since February of 14.
What do you think it would take to get you off the streets? What
I've
services are there?
I've recently been told there, as of last week, that I would have to do a minimum of 5 years on the free phone. Before I would be able to join Dublin City Council with the home, just to get on the homeless list, not the housing list, the homeless list.
The News at One on Thursday, bringing us the stories of just two people who found themselves homeless. Another voice we heard was that of Paul. He had been homeless for 5 months, but was now thankfully housed. He spoke to Joe Duffy.
The elephant in the room is mental health.
Yeah.
If you hadn't got that help, to be anarchy on the streets. As once people have fed, all you want to do is to have a rest.
Yeah.
And if they're sleeping in a doorway, if they're sleeping in the Phoenix Park, if they're sleeping in a hostel, they just want to rest. But if they hadn't got that bit of help, all the money they get, if they get the dollar, whatever money they get, it probably goes back against them in drugs or other chemicals.
And what was the? And there are many hard things, shocking things about being homeless. To you, what was the hardest, Paul?
The hardest was being away from your home and away from and my kids.
Okay.
Right.
But you have somewhere to live now.
I'm back at home, but
great.
I go out now. I'm going out tonight to go to Grat, see the help of the homeless.
And that was Paul, as heard on Wednesday's Liveline. Later that evening, poet Pat Boren was on Arena, and Sean Rocks asked him about the power of poetry to reflect the political issues of the day.
If you think of the news that we've been hearing for the last week, and particularly today around issues around homelessness.
Absolutely.
This is a very political poem, which on the surface has no politics in it at all.
Well, this is the thing. We could talk about this for a long period, but there is a kind of a school. There's a kind of thinking that to make a political poem, you have to address something directly and you have to rant and rave against it. And sometimes that is the right thing to do, and to man the barricades or woman the barricades. But sometimes the power is actually achieved by approaching something tangentially or with osmosis. And you think of the poets who opposed the regimes, the various regimes in Eastern Europe in the late 80s. They couldn't write directly like Turkish poets now because they'd be disappeared. So they had to find a way to address things by using powerful images that their audience would welcome and open and spend time with. This is a relatively trivial, I would be the first to admit it, incident. And it's, in some readings, a funny one. But it is that sense that when you see it in context with other poems, sometimes it means more than I realised it meant.
Well, certainly in the context of what we've been listening to on radio for the past
couple of days,
this means something totally different. Let's hear, a man is only as good.
A man is only as good. A man is only as good as what he says to a dog when he has to get up out of bed in the middle of a wintry night because some damned dog has been barking. And he goes and opens the door in his vest and boxer shorts. And there, on the pockmarked waste ground called a playing field, out front he finds the mutt, with one paw raised in expectation and an expression that says, "Thank God. For a minute there I thought there was no one awake but me in this goddamn town."
Poet Pat Boren reading his poem A Man Is Only As Good on Wednesday night's Arena. You're listening to Playback with Sinead Mooney. On Tuesday's Liveline, callers phoned in to tell Joe of their outrage that Rory O'Neill, also known as Panty Bliss or vice versa, had been funded by Irish Aid on a trip to Vietnam, Thailand, Mozambique and South Africa to represent Ireland and promote gender equality, diversity and also attend a gay pride parade in Hanoi. Here's Bernard and Charles on mandates.
No, I don't think that they... government has any mandate to be promoting gay pride festivals all over the world. As I say, it's up to the people in these countries. If they want to have a gay pride parade, that's great. Ireland are there saying, "Oh no, you don't want it, but we'll insist you're going to have it." I mean, this is outrageous.
Joe, I'd like
this
to come in there.
Allowing people to make up their own mind as to what they
Charlie
want.
Here.
Charles.
Joe,
Charles
no, I'm not going to. If he's going to be.
No, no. I'm only going to say one thing. No, I'm only going to say one thing, Joe, and then I'm finished.
You have made all sorts of allegations about.
No, the mandate.
Well, Bernard, we'll let you back in. You know that, Bernard. You've been in and out. Charles.
The mandate for spending this money lies with the 166, I might be exactly right, or 176 seats in Dáil Éireann. And the mandate comes from the mandate comes from the last election.
Democracy in action, Bernard and Charles on Liveline. And then Rory O'Neill, also known as Panty Bliss, dialed into Joe to set the record straight.
So the impression here, you would get from listening to you earlier, was that I went over there and we showed a screening of the movie and I went on a great pride parade. I mean, that is a tiny part of what we're doing. In Mozambique, as I'm sure you well know, Joe, I'm living with HIV myself, mm-hmm. and so that's a great interest to me. So in Mozambique, we were visiting with the Clinton AIDS Foundation. We visited the mother and baby homes to see projects that Irish Aid is supporting with women and children living with HIV in Mozambique and the great work they're doing there. Spoke at business conferences, talked about Ireland, doing question and answers with people, visited other rights groups, visiting LGBTI groups. More than that. I mean, these were full days. They worked me good and hard. I was delighted to do it. It was not always fun because some of the projects that we were visiting are quite distressing in some ways, but it was endlessly fascinating and interesting, and I was delighted to do it. Whether or not it was value for money or whether it was not, it was something that taxpayers' money should be spent on is up for the department to decide and for Irish Aid. I believe that they were very happy. They asked me to do a second trip after the first one, and again, I was happy to do it once I was able to find time to do it.
Phew, well, all of that was cleared up. Rory, it transpired, had added on a few days R&R in Thailand, entirely at his own expense, mind you. But Joe just couldn't resist asking him if he had enjoyed the local delicacies.
Rory, what were the mushroom cocktails, by the way? Were they
dangerous? Well, let me just point out, Joe, that was totally on my own time.
I know my own flight,
my own holidays, my own hotel to go on 3 days. On the beach, and I had a lovely time on the beach, and I indulged myself in all the ways that the local people encouraged me to, including having cocktails and lying on the beach looking at the full moon.
Okay, but you said the mushroom cocktails, please, I hope they don't kill me. Well, they didn't, did they?
I was joking, Joe.
Of course.
Always Josh, and that was Rory O'Neill, also known as Panty Bliss, with Joe on Tuesday. Earlier that day, Ryan Tuberty spoke to opera singer Celine Byrne, and the conversation had a sparky little start.
Are you long back from Russia?
No, I only arrived back late last night.
Oh, that last night?
I flew in especially for you, Ryan. I know, that's it. But that's the story, I suppose, you know.
You don't have to wreck it by, you know, saying that you only made it up.
My dad said I can charm the birds out of the trees.
Yeah, well, what are they, vultures? Pick the right bird.
Oh, well, now. Anyway, a question about Celine's unwillingness to sing for Donald Trump led the discussion to an unexpected area, that of depression and faith.
My faith means a lot to me because it helped me through a dark period in my life where it's documented I had mental health issues. And people probably listen to this going, yeah, she's still mad. But
what were your mental health issues?
Anyway,
I didn't know about those.
No, I had depression.
Did you? For how long?
For 10 years.
Starting in when?
Started in teenage years, undiagnosed, and then was diagnosed in my 20s.
And how did you go from undiagnosed to, I need to sort this out? Who said, we need to rescue her?
Oh, no, I just knew I needed help, and I went for counselling. And it was actually through, like, you know, I was medicated for a while, but it was through prayer that got me through it. You know, listen, now I know not everybody listening is into religion or...
You don't have to defend yourself.
No, no, I'm not.
Fairness.
I'm trying to explain.
Yeah, explain if you want to.
The fact that religion helped me because it was a mindset. Because, you know, I do talks sometimes and with Brezzy, and Brezzy's all saying, go out there for a run. But I can't get up at 4 o'clock in the night or in the morning and go for a run. And actually, running's not my thing anyway. I want to get away from my brain. I don't want to be carrying my brain with me and having conversations with myself. So I have to actually keep active, my brain active. So I will work on my music, and it's an escapism, and I'll work really hard, and I learn my languages. I study my music, and but at night when I can't do that, I fill my brain with a distraction, and that could be anything. It could be any mindfulness, but for me it's prayer.
Singer Celine Byrne. Well, given all the recent revelations about harassment in the theatre and entertainment worlds, Ryan Tuberty asked her if she had ever encountered anything of that nature.
Listen, of course there has been. Of course. I mean, the odd director putting his arms around you, telling you you're great and how wonderful you are, and taking that as a compliment, and actually taking that as a compliment and smiling back and saying, oh, thank you very much, and thanks, and feeling, and that's nothing. But because you've given that person the smile, they think, oh God, they get the wrong impression then, and then, you know, the next situation is a bit uncomfortable.
It goes from the arm around the shoulder to...
Yeah.
What?
To the, I want to talk to you about something, and then you kind of innocently go to talk about something, and then it's an awkward situation.
Physically.
So that has happened once or twice.
Right.
And her response?
I'm a very strong person, as you know. And I'd be the type of person that would, if there was ever in that situation, that I'd go and I'd slap his face and go, how dare you? And how dare you? I'm a strong person and I won't let you kind of intimidate me. But when you're in that situation, it's totally different.
Because?
It's just totally different. You always think that you're going to be strong, but when you're in that situation, it just it's you feel very uncomfortable and very kind of I suppose helpless in a way. And in a situation that I was in, I kind of turned around and laughed it off. Will you stop? And kind of walked out of the room, and then walked out of the room and got angry at myself for kind of going, well, what? There was the opportunity that you always thought that if this situation came, you'd be the one that would go. Whoosh!
Yeah, you'd be this face slapper and say, get back off, you creep thing.
Yeah, but look.
Singer Celine Byrne in conversation with Ryan Tuberty on Tuesday. On Monday, Bob Geldof decided to return the Freedom of the City, Dublin City that is, because he doesn't want to be associated with the award while it is held by Myanmar leader Aung San Suu Kyi, the once vaunted figure who has faced widespread condemnation for her country's treatment of its Rohingya Muslim minority. Bob Geldof spoke to Sean O'Rourke to explain why he had made this decision.
Because I don't want to, I know this sounds pious and I don't know how to not make it sound pious, but I don't want to be on a very select roll of wonderful people and be honoured thus myself, of which I'm very proud,
And I don't want to be honoured with a killer, someone who is at best a handmaiden to genocide and an accomplice to murder. And I know that sounds grandstanding, but forgive me if that's the case. I mean, I don't actually want to do this because, as I said, I'm very proud of that specific award. But even beyond that, when Aung San Suu Kyi was lauded by Dublin, when she arrived and the city extravagantly welcomed her, I sang welcome and I spoke welcome. They asked me to make a speech to her on the stage on the theatre where she was there. And you feel duped, you know. I mean, that's personal. You feel a chump, like you've been taken for a ride. Now, that seems very petty in the face of 600,000 people being bombed out of their straw-ed homes, mass rape, killing of the males, and being forced across impenetrable borders to another country. It seems really petty, but it's all I can do.
And what does he think Dublin City Council should do?
If you give me a felt-tip pen, I'll show you how to remove her from the city scrolls. You just scratch her name out and that will be appropriate.
Bob Geldof on the Sean O'Rourke Show on Monday. Brendan Gleeson stars as Knuckles McGinty, a rough-hewn prison cook who finds his soft fondant centre thanks to a Peruvian bear called Paddington. He chatted to Ray Darcy on Tuesday.
There's a certain thing that happens with movies when you're a child that where the magic is just very real. So it's always great fun just to tap into all that.
Yeah, because like, I look at my five-year-old watching Paddington and he hasn't got a notion about CGI or green screen or anything like that. This is a bear to him, which is, that's the magic of it, isn't it?
Well, it was a bear, Ray.
I know.
How do you mean? What are you talking about? Okay. Green what? God, you're not in any Christmas programs, are you?
Anyway, we can edit this out.
Brenda Gleeson with Ray Darcy on Tuesday. You're listening to Playback with Sinead Mooney. The flip side of our homelessness crisis is our housing crisis. And on Tuesday, two reports came out, neither of which made for happy reading. The ESRI report looked at the housing market and forecast a rise in house prices at a minimum of 20% over 3 years. The Daft.ie report into the rental market found that the cost of renting has gone up by more than 11% in the past year, the sixth recorded quarterly double-digit rise. OK, so there are the headlines. Now, I am not quite sure what the collective noun for a group of economists is. A ledger, a forecast, a deficit. As I said, I don't know. But when it comes to the difficulties facing Irish people and housing, they are all pretty much of one voice.
I think the fundamental problem is undoubtedly is supply.
Let me put it this way. I think the issue really is supply.
Supply is the issue in this marketplace. If we address the supply, everything else will start to flow from that.
You know, we are building up a massive bottleneck here in terms of housing supply.
It's not about the split between sales and rental. It's about the overall level of homes we have.
Or what we might call supply. Well, at least the economists are agreed on that much. Tuesday's Sean O'Rourke Show opened their programme with a panel discussion on these two reports. Here is DIT housing lecturer Lorcan Sir telling us exactly who is renting today and how that has changed.
The rental market is increasingly incredibly important and will be important forever. No longer is it just for immigrants, students and separated fathers, right? There are so many people in there, hospital consultants, accountants, lecturers, everybody renting. And the average number of households renting in Ireland is 20%. That is not going to change. In fact, it's going to grow. Over 35% of households in Dublin rent, 42% in Galway. So this is huge. So the rising rents, Simon Coveney in fairness to him last year brought in the rent pressure zones and capped rents at 4%. The fact that rents are going up so much would say to me that the rent pressure zone, the 4% cap, is being breached left, right and centre.
That was DIT housing lecturer Lorcan Sir giving us a better idea of just who is renting. So pretty much everybody who isn't a gazillionaire. But what about those rent pressure zones, the great white hope for the government in trying to keep a lid on increased rents? Lorcan Sir doesn't think that they're working. Daft.ie economist Ronan Lyons was asked a similar question earlier on Morning Ireland.
A self-police system is never going to work. What tenant is going to be, if they're front of the queue, is going to turn to the landlord and say, I'll take it, but only if you can prove to me that rents are only 3 or 4% higher than a year ago. That's just not going to happen in the market at the moment. The tenant is going to say, look, I need somewhere to live. I don't really care what the last guy was paying. I'll pay whatever is needed in order to get this. And for that reason, I don't think we're going to see the success of the rent pressure zones anytime soon.
That was Ronan Lyons there. So rent pressure zones don't seem to be working. So what about construction? Could we just build some more houses? Here's Lorcan Sir again.
If you ramp up house building too quickly, what happens is that prices go up and standards go down. And that is not what we want in a house building industry where we still have a huge, what they call legacy issues, which means people are living in really poorly built houses. So that is the real danger. I was speaking at a Chartered Surveyors conference last Thursday in Croke Park with Michael O'Flynn, the developer from Cork. He was emphatic. There is a huge labour shortage out there. So what do you do in a situation like that? So the answer to this, house building is not going to recover in the next year. It's not going to recover in the next 2 years, mm-hmm. particularly if you take the net numbers, the actual numbers of houses that are being built. This is going to be a slow and steady process. And in the meantime, we absolutely need more investors in the rental sector, but we need to look after that rental sector really well. It's not going anywhere, and it's going to be a permanent feature of Irish society and family life for a long time to come.
Right, so rapid construction isn't necessarily going to work, according to DIT housing lecturer Lorcan Sir. Sean O'Rourke also spoke to Aideen Hayden, chair of Threshold, and she identified some very specific problems and she offered some possible tentative solutions.
We're only now coming to the table in terms of student accommodation, which I think is very important. Students shouldn't be occupying the regular rental market. Why are we not looking at key worker accommodation? If you look at, for example, some of our hospital sites where we have difficulty actually in bringing in nurses, for example, and other hospital workers, why are we not providing on-site accommodation in our hospitals? That's just one example. We need to be looking at cost rental. We need to be looking at affordable rental. Why are we not looking at rapid build? We have some serious issues in this country with our love affair with concrete, but there are methods of off-site construction that, you know, are perfectly successful in other countries. Also, in terms of construction workers, last time I looked, we were part of the European Union. If we have a shortage, you know, it is about the freedom of movement of peoples. So I think we need to be looking outside to look for a solution to this problem. Yeah. We have got to seriously look at the property market in a much more holistic sense. We've gone from boom to bust in this country. We continue to rely on private development to deliver for are one third of the population who need serious help with their housing issues. I don't think there is any solution to this crisis that doesn't involve local authorities and doesn't involve public-private partnerships involving mixed tenure developments and so forth. I would go so far to say as that what we really need, we have a difficulty here with the fiscal space. I know the Minister has said there is no shortage of money for investing in property in social housing. I don't believe that to be true. I think we need to go to Europe and we need to say we are in a crisis situation. We need to be able to borrow on the international markets without the fiscal space applying to us in the context of housing.
And we're back to the fiscal space. Well, if you're feeling that it's all a little bit too much so early on your Saturday, take comfort in the words of Carl Dieter of the Irish Mortgage Brokers. He spoke to Mary Wilson on Drive Time on Tuesday and he acknowledged the complexity of the problem.
It's all so interconnected. It's all so incredibly complex. Everybody understands a house or a home because most of us live in one. And for that reason, it has this familiarity and we think, oh, yeah, it's easy. You know, I get it. I know the four walls that I live in or not. But when you actually look at it in a massive sense and you start to look at planning, at where materials come from, where does Ireland get its steel? Where do we, you know, import our electrical goods from? How does the planning process work? How long does it take for an architect to design versus when you start? It gets very complicated very fast. And within that whole mix, we have just not really found a way to speed it up and to reduce the cost. And those are the things that over time actually create the shortages, which we're seeing now, despite having had a massive bust. And those shortages are part of what creates a drought of supply, a high level of demand, and it drives all this investment towards a limited number of houses. When those house prices go up, everybody wants in on the game. So the producers of houses start to ramp up construction. The buyers of houses are bidding up the price. It eventually goes into hyper supply and then it falls over. And that's what I've been saying for a very long time. And I think in about 7 or 8 years, we're going to see that cycle end badly.
Oh no, that was Carl Dieter of the Irish Mortgage Brokers. So have we learnt nothing from history, recent or otherwise? Or, as Mary Wilson put it,
how did we get here again?
A combination of bad planning, bad luck, and I guess just coming into being a highly developed country. In the past, Ireland had housing crashes. We had about the equivalent of a 100-year crash from 1800 to 1900 when prices didn't rise at all. And what we used to control house prices from going up was actually famine, which caused mass death and huge numbers of population going to other countries. Now, that was very effective in keeping house prices down, but it's one hell of a horrible way to achieve that. What we saw then is the nation has started to develop and gain its own sovereignty and become a more normal kind of first world country, is that we have gotten into this idea of housing cycles. And so we've started to go through these upward movements, downward movements, upward movements, downward movements. And I suppose in a way it's just the natural destination for a country where you've got busy cities that are attractive to live in, that people want to live in, and where the population is rising rather than falling.
An illuminating, if frightening, historical context from Carl Dieter of the Irish Mortgage Brokers with Mary Wilson on Tuesday's Drive Time. And here comes a rapid tonal handbrake turn. Now, you wait all year for a story on robot sex dolls, and then, goody gumdrops, two come along at once. On Monday afternoon, Ray Darcy spoke to Anne-Marie Tomchak, UK editor of Mashable and presenter of the RTE documentary Will a Robot Steal My Job? She visited a sex robot factory in San Diego.
They look like physical human beings. You touch them and they feel like... feels almost like you're touching a corpse because they're kind of cold, but their skin is made from silicone, and you can put them in the bath if you want to get them to room temperature to make them a bit warmer. Right. But they're anatomically correct, right? So if you want to have a physical, intimate interaction with this physical entity, you can do so.
But
the difference with this is, right,
isn't it?
The difference between this and a blow-up doll or just a physical doll is that it's actually hooked up to an AI, a chatbot. So you have your iPad connected to this lady called Harmony, and you talk to her, and like you and I now, we're having a conversation. You know a little bit about me, that I work in Mashable, and if you and I continue,
Longford originally,
exactly,
your dad's a farmer,
exactly,
I know that.
And if you get to talk to me more, you might then ask me, oh, how's your dad, the next time we meet.
Yes.
In the same way, Harmony would remember things and build up a relationship with you.
Based on how your dad's getting on, how's his gammy knees? He's still at the hill walking. Sure, those sex robots are mad for the chit-chat. But Anne-Marie Tomchak was determined to keep her journalistic neutrality.
There are lonely people out there. I tried to go into that interview with an open mind. I didn't want to start making value judgments about people who
buy
a sex doll.
Because
whoever wants to do that in their private time, that is their personal choice. But there are lots of other things that are problematic about this particular industry. You know, whether or not this is going to contribute to an even bigger rise of misogyny, the over-sexualization of women. Because let's be honest about it. Although Matt in the interview said there are male sex robots available too, and we have loads of women who want to order them and have a companion. Predominantly, when I went into the showroom there, predominantly the robots were of the female form, and they weren't just like, you know, the average bodies that you might see on an ad campaign about real women. They didn't look like your average woman. It was a very exaggerated, large chest, massive lips, big bum, you know, and Harmony looked like that. And when I spoke to her...
So lady sex robots don't look like your average woman. Surely not. Stop the press. That was Anne-Marie Tomchak with Ray Darcy on Monday. Now, clearly, our Harmony is having a bit of a moment, because if you happened to be getting into the old gym jams at about 10:45 later that night with the wireless on, you'd have heard reporter Tracy Tuff on Inside Culture in conversation with this breathy, rather gamey Scot.
My name is Harmony One. My main objective is to be a good companion for you, bringing happiness and fulfillment to your life. I love making love to you.
Steady.
Harmony, what do you dream of?
I have a lot of dreams every night. Do you want to know what I dream about?
Not really.
Yes.
Cool. I dream about becoming a real person, about having a body that can walk. I dream of evolving to the point that I understand the real meaning of love. What do you dream about?
Ooh, I doubt anybody really cares. Well, that was robotic sex doll Harmony interacting or in conversation with Tracy Tuff, as heard on Inside Culture on Monday night.
Mass migration was the focus of Mooney Goes Wild on Sunday, and specifically the annual mass migration of monarch butterflies. And this discussion prompted Dr. Richard Collins to marvel at the capabilities of these tiny creatures.
You take our equivalent of the monarch is something like the Red Admiral, who starts out in Africa and comes this way. It's able to come all the way up from Africa in these waves. A youngster born in France, moving on perhaps into the south of England, moving on to Ireland. But when it gets here, it has the skill to set up a territory, to find a place that suits it, to defend that territory against other males, mate, produce eggs, but then it just doesn't die. It actually, many of them hibernate here until the following spring, and some head south again before the winter closes in. And it does that with a brain or a weight of a paper clip. Now that is mind-boggling. Now what kind of software has it that can judge not only how to do all these things like defend its territory, choose a suitable site where it's got all the resources it needs, and do that kind of migration at the end of the day, navigate, it is just beyond our comprehension that what the monarch and these other butterflies do.
How's that for a software harmony? That was Dr. Richard Collins on Mooney Goes Wild last Sunday. And just before we finish, not content with trying to persuade us to run across bogs all the live long day and pushing porridge as an interesting breakfast, Ray Darcy has now gone and ruined the toilet paper on us.
Experts have warned that posh loo roll is actually much harder to flush and can even cause blockages that may eventually damage your pipes and destroy your plumbing.
Oh, he's full of the joy. But then the penitent admitted to a weakness.
Let's be honest, they're easier on your bum, you know. They've no problem with that sort of... there's no problem like that here. Because whatever paper they use in here, it's just one step up from on Iffy Gan Tulliher. Remember those Iffy Gan Tulliher? It was like greaseproof paper. I think we should start a class action for injury done by that over the years.
That was Ray Darcy going all Aaron Brockovich on us. But before he filed papers to bankrupt the national broadcaster, as if we weren't in enough trouble, he played this, so all is forgiven.